through Sundays, also featuring Chihive Yoga's gentle movement class in the event space, jeffersonvillebakeshop.com.
Good evening. Welcome to the Local Edition. News and information keeps you connected in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for joining us. The Kingfisher Project airs right here on the Local Edition, first Tuesday of every month. But when Bill Williams, the host of the show, gets a special interview, we've been taking up a couple of weeks for that. And that happened last month. It's happening again this month. Tonight, it's part two of Bill Williams' special interview with Sam Quinones. Let's hand it over to the Kingfisher Project for this half hour of the Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project. Information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Thanks, Julie. My guest today is Sam Quinones. Sam is a journalist, storyteller, former Los Angeles Times reporter, and author of three acclaimed books of narrative nonfiction, including the New York Times bestseller and National Book Critics Circle Award winner Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. His most recent book, just published in early November, is The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. You mentioned this in the book, that this fentanyl from Mexico and stuff isn't coming just to this country. It's also being sold around the world.
I think that's what the world's underworld has discovered. And I, for example, I don't know. I wouldn't be willing to make any prediction or anything about the country of Afghanistan. But I have to imagine that at a certain point, all their heroin production is going to suffer mightily. Well, now, what they can't, because fentanyl will simply do what it's done in the United States, and that's just outcompete, basically. People will get addicted to fentanyl. Those who don't die will get addicted to it, and they will just, heroin is worthless. Once you're addicted to fentanyl, your body's tolerance is so high, you need this amount. Now, the smaller amount of potency that heroin represents isn't going to do it for you. It's not going to keep the daily dope sickness, the withdrawal symptoms away. So you need fentanyl to do this, right? But and so that means fentanyl's worthless. Heroin is worthless. I was in a homeless encampment in Nashville last week, or a week before Thanksgiving, I should say. And you know, I met a guy who's a heroin addict a long time. Well, now he says, well, really, now I'm just a fentanyl addict. He says, a guy came into the encampment a week ago, he told me, and with black tar heroin, legitimate black tar heroin. And the guy comes to me and goes, I told him, that can't do me no good. I need fentanyl. The heroin will never do what I need it to do, which is keep the dope sickness away. Fentanyl is now the only thing that'll do it. So I think in Afghanistan, for example, I'm not sure if they're going to have much of a heroin market before too long. No, I don't want to predict anything. It's just like a hunch. But seriously, I don't know the country well enough, nor do I know the market in that part of the world well enough. But I would say that it does seem to me like a likely possibility.
Well, a little bit I've read that the poppy in Afghanistan is a monoculture, that all the other farming, most of the farming was turned toward growing heroin. And now there's not going to be any market. And my question is, and we don't need to talk about this at length here, but, you know, what are those farmers going to do?
Well, I mean, they still could sell that stuff as morphine for medicine. I mean, the opium, that's where morphine comes from. They just wouldn't make it into heroin. But that would not be the market that maybe they used to in terms of price, too. So I'm not sure. It's a good question. These are some of the questions that these changes are bringing about.
switch gears a little bit. What about the role of social media, especially among teens and young adults, in the growing sales and use of addictive drugs? Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, for example.
Yes. Well, this is a direct result of the supplies, the vast, vast supplies out of Mexico of these drugs. So if you think about what the drug dealer has typically always, the great dilemma that the drug dealer on the street or the mid-level guys always had, the dilemma is, where do I get my drugs to sell? Okay? This is always the problem. It's always been an issue. Guys get the one connection gets arrested, you lose that one, so where do I find the next guy? That kind of thing. Well, the supplies out of Mexico have essentially resolved that dilemma. There's no question. You can find many places where you can find these drugs in your region. I talked with a guy in the book, and him at least of us, that who said, when I was a meth dealer many years ago, and I was finding people who could sell me a few grams, and he takes a long vacation from that many years and then gets back into it for a variety of reasons we talk about in the book, and he finds that he's got now four guys within a 5-10 mile radius of his house who can sell him 20 pounds any day of the week. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of dope out there. So the big question now is not where do I get the dope I'm going to sell, it's where do I sell it? And particularly during COVID, when everyone's in the house and everyone's on the phone, what the answer to that was on social media apps. That became kind of the new street corner. And particularly so when you're a younger guy, it's kind of like a gateway place, it seems to me at this point. A gateway for drug travel. You want to get big, you want to get your supplies higher, you want to be able to bigger dealer. One place to start to make your first money is selling to on Snapchat. So frequently these are younger folks as well, 19, 20, 25, whatever, selling to people who might even be younger than they are. And part of this is possible because out of Mexico now they have taken to making counterfeit pills that look very much like pills that we know very well in the United States, Xanax, Percocet, Adderall, and also oxycodone generic 30 milligram pills. All of these pills are being made. They contain nothing, a counterfeit way, they're phony pills, but they contain nothing but fentanyl. So these pills are now coming into our country in just scandalous quantities, again, by the tens of millions, really. And what that means is that people are looking for ways of selling that. And one place they found, again, during COVID particularly, was on these social media apps and, of course, offering, if they're dealing with folks who are at home and can't leave, like kids, offering to deliver it. So home delivery became part of the mix as well in a lot of areas. And of course, a lot of the problem is, of course, a lot of these folks, these younger folks are not knowledgeable about what they're doing. They don't know the drug world. They don't know, they've got these like, these things are marketed to them with these fancy, menus and everything. And so they buy this stuff and they have no experience with fentanyl and they die very quickly. And so, I've seen thousands of kids die this way, particularly in the COVID year, because the supply is so great, it has made it easy for anybody to find the supply. And then the question becomes, where do they sell it? Well, social media is the answer.
You mentioned the gateway drug. I've thought a lot about that, and I've had people agree with me when I say adolescence is a gateway drug. But I'm also thinking that advertising is a gateway drug.
Oh, yeah. Adolescence is a gateway drug. That is a fascinating concept, though. I had not thought of it, and I think you are right. I'll have to consider that some more. But I agree. There's this moment when our brains are still developing. This gets into the neuroscience, I think, where our brains, the parts of our brains that develop first and throughout most of our teenage years is the part of our brain that's urging us for immediate gratification, reward systems in our brain and so on. The part that develops later is the part in the prefrontal cortex, the front or behind our forehead, essentially, in which is the part of the brain that forces us to weigh consequences and plan for the future and question whether or not this is the best idea or the best option for us. That part of the brain is really at a deficiency during the teenage years, and I think that's the main reason why adolescence is a gateway drug is because those parts of the brain that would most ask us to question what we're doing and look around for evidence of whether that's a good idea and slow down here, you know, that is not fully developed. It doesn't fully develop until according to the science on this, according to about the age 25, really, which is why you see some of the behavior that seems so juvenile among people who are juveniles, you know. So anyway, I would say that is part of it. And then, of course, marketing, I agree. We are just surrounded by stuff that's legal and addictive. Think about all the different, you know, fast food alone, fast food, soda, all that stuff, you know, alone. It's at every freeway off-ramp, at every major intersection. The logos don't change. You know, it's an interesting question, Bill. Ask yourself why those logos remain the same. Because those logos are triggers. Those logos, McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Pizza Hut, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can go on Pepsi, Coke, all that stuff. Those logos remain the same because they understand that those are triggers for our brains, that they push us to want what those folks are selling. And then you see other things like gambling. You saw during the World Series, there would be these apps that would come on, a guy's about to bat, and they go, you can bet on whether or not this guy is going to get a hit. You know, you have pornography, you have video games, which have been shown, I think, very much to be like heroin. And of course, the enormous topic of social media and cell phones and the addictive properties of all of that is just, of course, another thing we could talk about. But to me, it feels like we are being bombarded. And that is why I believe it's essential. Part of prevention now really needs to be in schools. And really probably just in the general population, is teaching us how our brains work, teaching us the struggle. We can teach that. There's so much we know about the brain nowadays. And when you learn how the brain works, I believe, it's my hunch, my feeling, because I've operated this way in my own daily life, that you can make then decisions that allow you to be free, to become free Americans, free of the crud that is constantly being bombarding us. You know, all the stuff that I just mentioned and a whole lot more. They're just telling us, you know, use this. This is, you know, they use the language of addiction, triggers, cravings. This will trigger cravings for our tacos as Taco Bell or McDonald's for hamburgers or whatever. You know, it's brazen. They understand. These are people who understand neuroscience. The people who don't understand neuroscience so much as us. We're the prey. Right, they've figured out how to attack that part of the brain that will give us the impulse to buy more. And along that continuum, at the far end of that continuum, it's not a stretch. I don't believe it by any means to say that along that continuum is the Sinaloa drug cartel and the traffickers down in Mexico and other parts of the world who have figured out the same thing, whether they know the neuroscience of it or not.
I'm Bill Williams, and we're talking with journalist and author Sam Quiñones. Our conversation continues after this break. We'll be right back.
Radio Catskill never stops growing and never stops appreciating our relationship with you. Whether it's broadening the world of new listeners or finding new ways to connect with what's happening where you live, your donations make everything we do possible. We hope you'll include Radio Catskill in your year-end giving plans. Make your year-end gift now to support public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected. On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction. I'm your host, Bill Williams. We're speaking with Sam Quiñones, author of the bestseller Dreamland, a document of the opioid crisis in Mexico and the United States. His new book, The Least of Us, expands that document to include the rise of synthetic drugs like fentanyl and the national crisis of community that's making addiction worse. At the end of the book, I believe it's in some notes, you mentioned that you're not a coffee drinker.
I'm not.
Is that a choice you've made, or longstanding?
It's a long-standing choice because I can't stand the taste of coffee. I Yeah, I've never been able to stomach this stuff. I know it's strange. I'm like one of the 2% of the world that doesn't drink coffee or something like that, but I never been able to handle it. Not to say I don't have an addictive propensity. I was addicted to nicotine cigarettes for 13 years, quit 9 times. That's, you know, it's the whole idea that part of understanding the brain is understanding that how important, how common relapse is, you know. So I quit 9 times, even though I knew how dangerous cigarettes were. But, you know, I just kept coming back to it and coming back to it until finally at 36, I took my last puff, and tobacco products have not touched my lips since then. I think you got to be that kind of disciplined with it. And I'm far beyond the discipline. I just don't crave it at all. I don't need it. I don't want it. I do like the smell of cigarettes. But.
You wrote, I think this is a chapter heading. Stop me if I'm wrong, but, and this is, lines up with stuff you've already talked about. We have modern skulls house a Stone Age mind.
Yes. And that's a quote from a study done by a couple that runs the Center for Evolutionary Biology, UC Santa Barbara. And this couple was really describing the state of affairs today. We have brains that have evolved over millions of years. They've evolved to keep us alive. They have evolved to keep us alive, and they've done a magnificent job of that. They have evolved to reward us with good feelings when we eat, when we have sex, when we are in community with other, when we're surrounded by other people, because the community aspect of our lives is not just a nice thing. It's been essential to why we as a species have survived these millions of years. Right? And it's also, our brains have also evolved to warn us immediately to bolt if we perceive danger. And the point that they were making in that study was to say that our brains have evolved to the way they did over millions of years. They have not been able to evolve in the last 40, 50 years to confront the growth of mass marketing, fast food, all the other stuff that I was talking about. So we are still a brain that prizes calories and conserves calories, except for that now, because that brain evolved over millions of years in a time when calories were scarce, sugar was scarce, fat was scarce, all of that was scarce, and now it's absolutely not. We can find more of this in a week than probably those folks millions of years ago could find in an entire year. And we're just, our brains are not prepared for it. The other thing that I think is interesting out of all that is that the neuroscience shows that drugs of abuse uniquely, even though the other stuff is addictive, it does not hit the brain and change and hijack the brain quite with the same power that drugs of abuse do, heroin, cocaine, et cetera, particularly the opioids. Those drugs, I think it was just such a remarkable thing. I just focused on this so much. I was blown away by when I came to understand what the neuroscientists were saying on this topic, the ones that I interviewed, which was that drugs of abuse mute all of that stuff that has evolved to keep us alive. If you're an addict, you're not really interested so much in food. You're not so much interested in sex. You're definitely isolating. You're not in community with other people. You're not being around other people unless the people can help you get your dope. You have one relationship, and that is with the drug, and that is it. It also, these drugs also mute that tendency to warn us when death approaches, which is why people overdose. The drug has simply taken over, hijack that person's brain. And I think the verb hijack is an apt one. If you think about the planes that took off on 9/11, right? They were instruments that were headed to, taking people to very healthy things, meeting family, on vacation, going to a business meeting. It was all just positive stuff. And then they're hijacked by the terrorists that took them over, just the same way drugs do. And in short order, drugs of abuse last quite a bit longer, of course, but in short order, that same vehicle that was taking all those people to their families and to business meetings and whatever vacation, now is turned and hijacked and turned against them and leads to their death. Well, that's very close to what drugs of abuse do to our brains, you know, and the marketing that takes place in the world is kind of the beginnings of that. Let's put it that way. Not that to say that everyone is going to become an addict, but I do hard drugs. But I do believe that many of us have been addicted to something: social media, shopping, pornography, video games, me with my nicotine, et cetera, et cetera. How many smokers or ex-smokers are there out there? So it's all part of this fascinating world of the brain that I really believe we need to be teaching to our students in high school. And that is not to say that there's a drug, we should pound them over the head, don't use drugs. We did that in the past, didn't seem to work too well. I think just simply educating people about how the brain works.
I couldn't agree with you more. As a former teacher, and still continuing to teach, and sometimes speaking to children in schools. We're running out of time, but where do you stand in terms of leading experts on addiction don't necessarily support criminalization? What are your thoughts on criminalization?
Well, it depends what you mean by that. If you mean arresting someone for having drugs or paraphernalia with an aim towards putting them in prison and then dumping them there, then that's not that we tried that, doesn't work, doesn't meet up with the brain science or anything like that. So I don't see the point of that. That's a whole other topic when you're talking about trafficking in large quantities and that kind of thing. That's a very different world, and I do believe in that, absolutely. But the small-time addict on the street, I think, frequently is in need of other things, and it's counterproductive and expensive and doesn't help that person in the least to just dump them somewhere and then try them and then put them in prison and dump them again. Okay. But there is a very different world out there now. And so the idea that you should decriminalize drugs to simply leave people on the street is a death sentence right now. Okay, there's a lot of evidence to show nobody survives on the street who's there's no such thing as a long term street user of fentanyl. It's just too difficult to mix. It's too dangerous. It doesn't matter what your tolerance is. You will find more of the dope at some point in whatever it is you're using, and you have to use it every day. It is an absolute Russian roulette kind of situation. So the idea that people are, we're just going to leave them out there because it's their choice. Yeah, what you understand, the brain science, you understand it's not so much of a choice anymore. And I don't believe that it's at all good. So what I think needs to happen is decriminalization needs to be modified significantly. And we need to understand that while we are not looking to put people in prison, we are absolutely looking to get them off the street. That there's no compassion in leaving people on the street to go insane from the meth or die or a combination of like both, you're insane until you die. There's no compassion show. That's as misguided compassion as I can imagine. And the COVID year showed that. The COVID year was really, it amounted to a quite unplanned, of course, but nevertheless, an experiment in decriminalizing drugs. And you can see that the results are record overdose deaths, and I submit to record amounts of homelessness, record amounts of mental illness due to this methamphetamine. So using the criminal justice system as a place to begin recovery. Now, that sounds bizarre to a lot of people. Hey, didn't we try the criminal justice system? Yeah, we did. First of all, a lot of people get sober and are helped by just being arrested. And I met many people say the best thing that ever happened to them was that they were arrested. But I think nowadays what we're seeing in the areas that have been at this longest, I mean, it's important to pay attention to what they've been trying. One of the things they've been trying is a brand new way, a very different way of doing jail, which has been a damaging thing all across this country for decades. The way it's traditionally been run has been really a bad thing for almost everybody. But now they're experimenting with new ways of doing jail. Jail is a place of recovery. And so before people start criticizing this idea, they need to visit some of these jails, read the chapters that I've written in The Least of Us about these jails. To me, that is the beginning. Then you augment that with drug courts. So people are kind of using the leverage of criminal charges to push them away from the dope. We need every piece of leverage we can to combat the power of this stuff. And that is, those are two options that I think use the criminal justice system in ways they haven't been used before, and get away from the idea that it's okay to leave people on the street and that someday they'll be ready for treatment. They'll die before readiness takes over. That's for sure. It's happening all across the country in the record numbers that we've seen.
We're near a close, unfortunately. I could talk to you about this forever. You begin Dreamland in Portsmouth, Ohio, or very early on in the book, and your last chapter, actually your epilogue, I believe, in your most recent book, The Least of Us, ends in Portsmouth with how that has turned around. And at one of the very last lines is you're talking to Josh Woods, who's returned, has made a recovery, personal recovery, and both sort of a professional recovery in Portsmouth. And he says, they got so much more plans for what all this is going to be. I'm so excited to be a part of it, to actually help it become what it's going to become. That, he said, is going to be a great story. And I'm wondering and I'm hoping that you'll be able to tell part of that story.
I sure hope so. But I think the reason I went to Portsmouth was, again, because it was a big part of Dreamland, of course, was because I saw there the exact in action what I'm talking about, this kind of idea that when you come together in small ways, working daily, unnoticed ways, with other people, finding the imagination that collaboration can inspire, getting away from dope, getting away from fatalism, negativity, inertia, and towards a more productive, positive way of viewing the world, that small steps lead in the long run to more positive, solid, and productive changes. And that's the story of Portsmouth, Ohio. Not that there's no drugs, not that everything's beautiful and wonderful and it's a heaven on earth and far from it, but simply to say, We need to understand the power of community. It's kept us alive for millions of years, and we got away from that. And when you find people who are actually understanding that and working on it, even in a very maybe way that they wouldn't even articulate, you find that it's actually there's some positive stuff that grows from that. And I think that that's a lesson the country might learn. It's the one I tried to impart in The Least of Us.
Well, that's why part of your book is called The Story of Hope.
Indeed. Indeed. It's strange because you're talking about some very dire stuff, right? Fentanyl, methamphetamine, mental illness, you know, overdose, record overdose death. So how can you find hope amid this very dire situation? We have it within us. Community is what allowed us to survive as a species for millions of years. And in America, we just got away from it. And when you find small versions of it happening, of people kind of understanding that they can, how they can work together and that kind of thing, And not expecting the world to change overnight, and not living on the feeling of virtue that, oh, I'm changing the world, but rather just daily small steps, daily work, you find how powerful that can be, you know. And that was the message of The Least of Us, the True Tales of America and Hope in a Time of Fentanyl and Meth. It was that idea that there is a lot of hope out there. We just need to reassess where we are as a country and maybe sometimes even as a neighborhood.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that reminder. Thank you for leading us in that direction.
Great talking with you, Bill.
Great,
I really appreciate it. Wonderful questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to Sam Quinones, author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth.
Okay, that's going to do it for this edition of The Local Edition. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Bill Williams and everybody with the Kingfisher Project. Tune in again tomorrow. We're going to do it again on The Local Edition starting at 6:30. You do want to stay tuned. We got Mr. Kusar Grace coming up for the Music Emporium here on Radio Catskill.
Join me, Staff Sergeant Sandberg, for our Christmas edition of Let's Talk Vets. Don Shawl will be by to update us on the latest news from the VA Hudson Valley Healthcare System. Then join us as we listen to a panel of experts for part one of our two-part discussion on veteran homelessness in the Hudson Valley. That's Wednesday, 7 p.m. on Radio Catskill, WJFF.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Arnold House, up on top of Chandelier, featuring 14 guest rooms, a seasonally rotating menu at the Tavern, Greenhouse Gardens, Barn, and more. TheArnoldHouse.com. From the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, HurleyvilleArtsCenter.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF, Jefferson.